This is Audible.
Audible Inc. presents Parallel Worlds, a journey through creation, higher dimensions, and the future of the cosmos, by Michio Kaku, read by Mark Vitor.
Chapter 7. M-Theory, the Mother of All Strings. To someone who could grasp the universe from a unified standpoint, the entire creation would appear as a unique truth and necessity. J. D'Alembert. I feel that we are so close with string theory that, in my moments of greatest optimism, I imagine that any day the final form of the theory might drop out of the sky and land in someone's lap. But more realistically, I feel that we are now in the process of constructing a much deeper theory than anything we have had before, and that well into the 21st century, when I am too old to have any useful thoughts on the subject, younger physicists will have to decide whether we have in fact found the final theory. Edward Witten. H.G. Wells's classic novel of 1897, The Invisible Man, begins with a strange tale. One cold, wintry day, a stranger comes in from the darkness dressed in a bizarre fashion. His face is completely covered. He is wearing dark blue glasses, and a white bandage blankets his entire face. At first, the villagers take pity on him, thinking that he was in a horrible accident. But strange things happen around the village. One day, his landlady entered his empty room and screamed when she saw clothing moving about by itself. Hats were whirling across the room, the bedclothes leaped into the air, chairs moved, and the furniture went mad, she recalled in horror. Soon, the entire village is buzzing with rumors of these unusual occurrences. Finally, a group of villagers gathers and confronts the mysterious stranger. To their amazement, he slowly begins to unwrap his bandages. The crowd is aghast. Without the bandages, the stranger's face is completely missing. In fact, he is invisible. Chaos erupts as people yell and scream. The villagers try to chase the invisible man, who easily fights them off. After committing a string of petty crimes, the invisible man seeks out an old acquaintance and recounts his remarkable story. His true name is Mr. Griffin of University College. Although he started out learning medicine, he stumbled upon a revolutionary way in which to change the refractive and reflective properties of flesh. His secret is the fourth dimension. He exclaims to Dr. Kemp, "I found a general principle, a formula, a geometrical expression involving four dimensions." Sadly, instead of using this great discovery to help humanity, his thoughts are of robbery and private gain. He proposes to recruit his friend as an accomplice. Together, he claims, they can plunder the world. But the friend is horrified and reveals Mr. Griffin's presence to the police. This leads to a final manhunt in which the invisible man is mortally wounded. As with the best science fiction novels, there is a germ of science in many of H.G. Wells's tales. Anyone who can tap into the fourth spatial dimension, or what is today called the fifth dimension, with time being the fourth dimension, can indeed become invisible, and can even assume the powers normally ascribed to ghosts and gods. Imagine, for the moment, that a race of mythical beings can inhabit the two-dimensional world of a tabletop, as in Edwin Abbott's 1884 novel Flatland. They conduct their affairs unaware that an entire universe, the third dimension, surrounds them. But if a Flatland scientist could perform an experiment that allows him to hover inches off the table, he would become invisible, because light would pass below him as if he didn't exist. Floating just above Flatland, he could see events unfolding below on the tabletop. Hovering in hyperspace has decided advantages, for anyone looking down from hyperspace would have the powers of a god. Not only would light pass beneath him, making him invisible, he could also pass over objects. In other words, he could disappear at will and walk through walls. By simply leaping into the third dimension, he would vanish from the universe of Flatland. And if he jumped back onto the tabletop, he would suddenly rematerialize out of nowhere. He could therefore escape from any jail. A prison in Flatland would consist of a circle drawn around a prisoner, so it would be easy to simply jump into the third dimension and be outside. It would be impossible to keep secrets away from a hyper-being. Gold that is locked in a vault could be easily seen from the vantage point of the third dimension, since the vault is just an open rectangle. It would be child's play to reach into the rectangle and lift the gold out without ever breaking into the vault. Surgery would be possible without cutting the skin. Similarly, H.G. Wells wanted to convey the idea that in a four-dimensional world, we are the Flatlanders, oblivious of the fact that higher planes of existence might hover right above ours. We believe that our world consists of all that we can see, unaware that there may be entire universes right above our noses. Although another universe might be hovering just inches above us, floating in the fourth dimension, it would appear to be invisible. Because a hyper-being would possess superhuman powers usually ascribed to a ghost or a spirit, in another science fiction story, H.G. Wells pondered the question of whether supernatural beings might inhabit higher dimensions. He raised a key question that is today the subject of great speculation and research. Could there be new laws of physics in these higher dimensions? In his 1895 novel, The Wonderful Visit, a vicar's gun accidentally hits an angel who happens to be passing through our dimension. For some cosmic reason, our dimension and a parallel universe temporarily collided, allowing this angel to fall into our world. In the story, Wells writes, "There may be any number of three-dimensional universes packed side by side." The vicar questions the wounded angel. He is shocked to find that our laws of nature no longer apply in the angel's world. In his universe, for example, there are no planes, but rather cylinders, so space itself is curved. Fully 20 years before Einstein's general theory of relativity, Wells was entertaining thoughts about universes existing on curved surfaces. As the vicar puts it, "Their geometry is different because their space has a curve in it so that all their planes are cylinders, and their law of gravitation is not according to the law of inverse squares, and there are 24 primary colors instead of only 3. More than a century after Wells wrote his tale, physicists today realize that new laws of physics, with different sets of subatomic particles, atoms, and chemical interactions, might indeed exist in parallel universes. As we see in Chapter 9, several experiments are now being conducted to detect the presence of parallel universes that might be hovering just above ours. The concept of hyperspace has intrigued artists, musicians, mystics, theologians, and philosophers, especially near the beginning of the 20th century. According to art historian Linda Dalrymple Henderson, Pablo Picasso's interest in the fourth dimension influenced the creation of cubism. The eyes of the women he painted look directly at us, even though their noses face to the side, allowing us to view the women in their entirety. Similarly, a hyper-being looking down on us will see us in our entirety, front, back, and sides simultaneously. In his famous painting, Christus Hypercubus, Salvador Dalí painted Jesus Christ crucified in front of an unraveled four-dimensional hypercube, or a tesseract. In his painting, The Persistence of Memory, Dalí tried to convey the idea of time as the fourth dimension, with melted clocks. In Marcel Duchamp's painting, Nude Descending a Staircase, No. 2, we see a nude in time-lapse motion walking down the stairs, in another attempt to capture the fourth dimension of time on a two-dimensional surface. M-theory. Today, the mystery and lore surrounding the fourth dimension are being resurrected for an entirely different reason. The development of string theory and its latest incarnation, M-theory. Historically, the concept of hyperspace has been resisted strenuously by physicists. They scoffed that higher dimensions were the province of mystics and charlatans. Scientists who seriously proposed the existence of unseen worlds were subject to ridicule. With the coming of M-theory, all that has changed. Higher dimensions are now in the center of a profound revolution in physics because physicists are forced to confront the greatest problem facing physics today, the chasm between general relativity and the quantum theory. Remarkably, these two theories comprise the sum total of all physical knowledge about the universe at the fundamental level. At present, only M-theory has the ability to unify these two great, seemingly contradictory theories of the universe into a coherent whole, to create a theory of everything. Of all the theories proposed in the past century, the only candidate that can potentially read the mind of God, as Einstein put it, is M-theory. Only in 10 or 11-dimensional hyperspace do we have enough room to unify all the forces of nature in a single elegant theory. Such a fabulous theory would be able to answer the eternal questions, what happened before the beginning? Can time be reversed? Can dimensional gateways take us across the universe? Although its critics correctly point out that testing this theory is beyond our present experimental ability, there are a number of experiments currently being planned that may change this situation, as we shall see in Chapter 9. All attempts for the past 50 years to create a truly unified description of the universe have ended in ignominious failure. Conceptually, this is easy to understand. General relativity and the quantum theory are diametrical opposites in almost every way. General relativity is a theory of the very large, black holes, big bangs, quasars, and the expanding universe. It is based on the mathematics of smooth surfaces like bedsheets and trampoline nets. The quantum theory is precisely the opposite. It describes the world of the very tiny, atoms, protons and neutrons, and quarks. It is based on a theory of discrete packets of energy called quanta. Unlike relativity, the quantum theory states that only the probability of events can be calculated, so we can never know for sure precisely where an electron is located. These two theories are based on different mathematics, different assumptions, different physical principles, and different domains. It is not surprising that all attempts to unify them have floundered. The giants of physics, Erwin Schrödinger, Werner Heisenberg, Wolfgang Pauli and Arthur Eddington, who have followed Einstein, have tried their hand at a unified field theory, only to fail miserably. In 1928, Einstein accidentally created a media stampede with an early version of his unified field theory. The New York Times even published parts of the paper, including his equations. Over 100 reporters swarmed outside his house. Writing from England, Eddington commented to Einstein, "You may be amused to hear that one of our great department stores in London, Selfridges, has posted on its window your paper, the 6 pages pasted up side by side, so that passers-by can read it all through. Large crowds gather around to read it." In 1946, Erwin Schrödinger also caught the bug and discovered what he thought was the fabled unified field theory. Hurriedly, he did something rather unusual for his time, but which is not so unusual today. He called a press conference. Even Ireland's Prime Minister, Eamon de Valera, showed up to listen to Schrödinger. When asked how certain he was that he had finally bagged the unified field theory, he replied, "I believe I am right. I shall look like an awful fool if I am wrong." The New York Times eventually found out about this press conference and mailed the manuscript to Einstein and others for comment. Sadly, Einstein realized that Schrödinger had rediscovered an old theory that he had proposed years earlier and had rejected. Einstein was polite in his response, but Schrödinger was humiliated. In 1958, physicist Jeremy Bernstein attended a talk at Columbia University where Wolfgang Pauli presented his version of the unified field theory, which he developed with Werner Heisenberg. Niels Bohr, who was in the audience, was not impressed. Finally, Bohr rose up and said, "We in the back are convinced that your theory is crazy, but what divides us is whether your theory is crazy enough." Pauli immediately knew what Bohr meant, that the Heisenberg-Pauli theory was too conventional, too ordinary to be the unified field theory. To read the mind of God would mean introducing radically different mathematics and ideas. Many physicists are convinced that there is a simple, elegant, and compelling theory behind everything that nonetheless is crazy and absurd enough to be true. John Wheeler of Princeton points out that in the 19th century, explaining the immense diversity of life found on Earth seemed hopeless. But then Charles Darwin introduced the theory of natural selection, and a single theory provided the architecture to explain the origin and diversity of all life on Earth. Nobel laureate Steven Weinberg uses a different analogy. After Columbus, the maps detailing the daring exploits of the early European explorers strongly indicated that there must exist a North Pole, but there was no direct proof of its existence. Because every map of Earth showed a huge gap where the North Pole should be located, the early explorers simply assumed that a North Pole should exist, although none of them had ever visited it. Similarly, the physicists of today, like the early explorers, find ample indirect evidence pointing to the existence of a theory of everything, although at present there is no universal consensus on what that theory is. History of string theory. One theory that clearly is crazy enough to be the unified field theory is string theory, or M theory. String theory has perhaps the most bizarre history in the annals of physics. It was discovered quite by accident, applied to the wrong problem, relegated to obscurity, and suddenly resurrected as a theory of everything. And in the final analysis, because it is impossible to make small adjustments without destroying the theory, it will either be a theory of everything or a theory of nothing. The reason for this strange history is that string theory has been evolving backward. Normally, in a theory like relativity, one starts with fundamental physical principles. Later, these principles are honed down to a set of basic classical equations. Last, one calculates quantum fluctuations to these equations. String theory evolved backward, starting with the accidental discovery of its quantum theory. Physicists are still puzzling over what physical principles may guide the theory. The origin of string theory dates back to 1968, when two young physicists at the nuclear laboratory at CERN, Geneva, Gabriel Veneziano and Mahiko Suzuki, were independently flipping through a math book and stumbled across the Euler beta function, an obscure 18th-century mathematical expression discovered by Leonard Euler, which strangely seemed to describe the subatomic world. They were astonished that this abstract mathematical formula seemed to describe the collision of two pi meson particles at enormous energies. The Veneziano model soon created quite a sensation in physics, with literally hundreds of papers attempting to generalize it to describe the nuclear forces. In other words, the theory was discovered by pure accident. Edward Witten of the Institute for Advanced Study, whom many believe to be the creative engine behind many of the stunning breakthroughs in the theory, has said, "By rights, 20th-century physicists shouldn't have had the privilege of studying this theory. By rights, string theory shouldn't have been invented." I vividly remember the stir string theory created. I was still a graduate student in physics at the University of California at Berkeley at that time, and I recall seeing physicists shaking their heads and stating that physics was not supposed to be this way. In the past, physics was usually based on making painfully detailed observations of nature, formulating some partial hypothesis, carefully testing the idea against the data, and then tediously repeating the process over and over again. String theory was a seat-of-your-pants method based on simply guessing the answer. Such breathtaking shortcuts were not supposed to be possible. Because subatomic particles cannot be seen, even with our most powerful instruments, physicists have resorted to a brutal but effective way to analyze them, by smashing them together at enormous energies. Billions of dollars have been spent building huge atom smashers or particle accelerators, which are many miles across, creating beams of subatomic particles that collide into each other. Physicists then meticulously analyze the debris from the collision. The goal of this painful and arduous process is to construct a series of numbers called the scattering matrix, or S-matrix. This collection of numbers is crucial because it encodes within it all the information of subatomic physics. That is, if one knows the S-matrix, one can deduce all the properties of the elementary particles. One of the goals of elementary particle physics is to predict the mathematical structure of the S-matrix for the strong interactions, a goal so difficult that some physicists believed it was beyond any known physics. One can then imagine the sensation caused by Veneziano and Suzuki when they simply guessed the S-matrix by flipping through a math book. The model was a completely different kind of animal from anything we had ever seen before. Usually, when someone proposes a new theory, such as quarks, physicists try to tinker with the theory, changing simple parameters, like the particles' masses or coupling strengths. But the Veneziano model was so finely crafted that even the slightest disturbance in its basic symmetries ruined the entire formula. As with a delicately crafted piece of crystal, any attempt to alter its shape would shatter it. Of the hundreds of papers that trivially modified its parameters, thereby destroying its beauty, none have survived today. The only ones that are still remembered are those that sought to understand why the theory worked at all, that is, those that tried to reveal its symmetries. Eventually, physicists learned that the theory had no adjustable parameters whatsoever. The Veneziano model, as remarkable as it was, still had several problems. First, physicists realized that it was just a first approximation to the final S-matrix and not the whole picture. Bunji Sakita, Miguel Virasoro, and Keiji Kikawa, then at the University of Wisconsin, realized that the S-matrix could be viewed as an infinite series of terms, and that the Veneziano model was just the first and most important term in the series. Crudely speaking, each term in the series represents the number of ways in which particles can bump into each other. They postulated some of the rules by which one could construct the higher terms in their approximation. For my PhD thesis, I decided to rigorously complete this program and construct all possible corrections to the Veneziano model. Along with my colleague LPU, I calculated the infinite set of correction terms to the model. Finally, Yoichiro Nambu of the University of Chicago and Tetsuo Goto of Nihon University identified the key feature that made the model work: a vibrating string. Work along these lines was also done by Leonard Susskind and Holger Nielsen. When a string collided with another string, it created an S-matrix described by the Veneziano model. In this picture, each particle is nothing but a vibration or note on the string. I discuss this concept in detail later. Progress was very rapid. In 1971, John Schwartz, André Neveu, and Pierre Ramon generalized the string model so that it included a new quantity called spin, making it a realistic candidate for particle interactions. All subatomic particles, as we shall see, appear to be spinning like a miniature top. The amount of spin of each subatomic particle in quantum units is either an integer, like 0, 1, 2, or a half integer, like 1 over 2, 3 over 2. Remarkably, the Neveu-Schwartz-Ramon string gave precisely this pattern of spins. I was, however, still unsatisfied. The dual resonance model, as it was called back then, was a loose collection of odd formulas and rules of thumb. All physics for the previous 150 years had been based on fields, since they were first introduced by British physicist Michael Faraday. Think of the magnetic field lines created by a bar magnet. Like a spider web, the lines of force permeate all space. At every point in space, you can measure the strength and direction of the magnetic lines of force. Similarly, a field is a mathematical object that assumes different values at every point in space. Thus, the field measures the strength of the magnetic, electrical, or the nuclear force at any point in the universe. Because of this, the fundamental description of electricity, magnetism, the nuclear force, and gravity is based on fields. Why should strings be different? What was required was a field theory of strings that would allow one to summarize the entire content of the theory into a single equation. In 1974, I decided to tackle this problem. With my colleague Keiji Kikawa of Osaka University, I successfully extracted the field theory of strings. In an equation barely an inch and a half long, we could summarize all the information contained within string theory. Once the field theory of strings was formulated, I had to convince the larger physics community of its power and beauty. I attended a conference in theoretical physics at the Aspen Center in Colorado that summer and gave a seminar to a small but select group of physicists. I was quite nervous. In the audience were two Nobel laureates, Murray Gell-Mann and Richard Feynman, who were notorious for asking sharp, penetrating questions that often left the speaker flustered. Once, when Steven Weinberg was giving a talk, he wrote down on the blackboard an angle, labeled by the letter W, which is called the Weinberg angle in his honor. Feynman then asked what the W on the blackboard represented. As Weinberg began to answer, Feynman shouted, "Wrong!" which broke up the audience. Feynman may have amused the audience, but Weinberg got the last laugh. This angle represented a crucial part of Weinberg's theory, which united the electromagnetic and weak interactions, and which would eventually win him the Nobel Prize. In my talk, I emphasized that string field theory would produce the simplest, most comprehensive approach to string theory, which was largely a motley collection of disjointed formulas. With string field theory, the entire theory could be summarized in a single equation about an inch and a half long. All the properties of the Veneziano model, all the terms of the infinite perturbation approximation, and all the properties of spinning strings could be derived from an equation that would fit onto a fortune cookie. I emphasized the symmetries of string theory that gave it its beauty and power. When strings move in space-time, they sweep out two-dimensional surfaces, resembling a strip. The theory remains the same, no matter what coordinates we use to describe this two-dimensional surface. I will never forget that afterward, Feynman came up to me and said, "I may not agree totally with string theory, but the talk you gave is one of the most beautiful I have ever heard." 10 dimensions. But just as string theory was taking off, it quickly unraveled. Claude Lovelace of Rutgers discovered that the original Veneziano model had a tiny mathematical flaw that could only be eliminated if space-time had 26 dimensions. Similarly, the superstring model of Neveu, Schwartz, and Ramon could only exist in 10 dimensions. This shocked physicists. This had never been seen before in the entire history of science. Nowhere else do we find a theory that selects out its own dimensionality. Newton's and Einstein's theories, for example, can be formulated in any dimension. The famed inverse square law of gravity, for example, can be generalized to an inverse cube law in four dimensions. String theory, however, could only exist in specific dimensions. From a practical point of view, this was a disaster. Our world, it was universally believed, existed in three dimensions of space, length, width, and breadth, and one of time. To admit a ten-dimensional universe meant that the theory bordered on science fiction. String theorists became the butt of jokes. John Schwartz remembers riding in the elevator with Richard Feynman, who jokingly said to him, "Well, John, and how many dimensions do you live in today?" But no matter how string physicists tried to salvage the model, it quickly died. Only the diehards continued to work on the theory. It was a lonely effort during this period. Two diehards who continued to work on the theory during those bleak years were John Schwartz of Caltech and Joel Schurk of the École Normale Supérieure in Paris. Until then, the string model was supposed to describe just the strong nuclear interactions. But there was a problem. The model predicted a particle that did not occur in the strong interactions, a curious particle with zero mass that possessed two quantum units of spin. All attempts to get rid of this pesky particle had failed. Every time one tried to eliminate this spin-2 particle, the model collapsed and lost its magical properties. Somehow, this unwanted spin-2 particle seemed to hold the secret of the entire model. Then, Schurk and Schwartz made a bold conjecture. Perhaps the flaw was actually a blessing. If they reinterpreted this worrisome spin-2 particle as the graviton, a particle of gravity arising from Einstein's theory, then the theory actually incorporated Einstein's theory of gravity. In other words, Einstein's theory of general relativity simply emerges as the lowest vibration or note of the superstring. Ironically, while in other quantum theories physicists strenuously tried to avoid including any mention of gravity, string theory demands it. That, in fact, is one of the attractive features of string theory, that it must include gravity, or else the theory is inconsistent. With this daring leap, scientists realized that the string model was incorrectly being applied to the wrong problem. It was not meant to be a theory of just the strong nuclear interactions. It was instead a theory of everything. As Witten has emphasized, one attractive feature of string theory is that it demands the presence of gravity. While standard field theories have failed for decades to incorporate gravity, gravity is actually obligatory in string theory. Schurk and Schwartz's seminal idea, however, was universally ignored. For string theory to describe both gravity and the subatomic world, it meant that the strings would have to be only 10 to the negative 33rd power centimeters long, the Planck length. In other words, they were a billion billion times smaller than a proton. This was too much for most physicists to accept. But by the mid-1980s, other attempts at a unified field theory had floundered. Theories that tried to naively attach gravity to the standard model were drowning in a morass of infinities, which I shall explain shortly. Every time someone tried to artificially marry gravity with the other quantum forces, it led to mathematical inconsistencies that killed the theory. Einstein believed that perhaps God had no choice in creating the universe. One reason for this might be that only a single theory is free of all these mathematical inconsistencies. There were two such kinds of mathematical inconsistencies. The first was the problem of infinities. Usually, quantum fluctuations are tiny. Quantum effects are usually only a small correction to Newton's laws of motion. This is why we can, for the most part, ignore them in our macroscopic world. They are too small to be noticed. However, when gravity is turned into a quantum theory, these quantum fluctuations actually become infinite, which is nonsense. The second mathematical inconsistency has to do with anomalies, small aberrations in the theory that arise when we add quantum fluctuations to a theory. These anomalies spoil the original symmetry of the theory, thereby robbing it of its original power. For example, think of a rocket designer who must create a sleek, streamlined vehicle to slice through the atmosphere. The rocket must possess great symmetry in order to reduce air friction and drag, in this case, cylindrical symmetry, so the rocket remains the same when we rotate it around its axis. This symmetry is called O2. But there are two potential problems. First, because the rocket travels at such great velocity, vibrations can occur in the wings. Usually, these vibrations are quite small in subsonic airplanes. However, traveling at hypersonic velocities, these fluctuations can grow in intensity and eventually tear the wing off. Similar divergences plague any quantum theory of gravity. Normally, they are so small they can be ignored, but in a quantum theory of gravity, they blow up in your face. The second problem with the rocket ship is that tiny cracks may occur in the hull. These flaws ruin the original O2 symmetry of the rocket ship. Tiny as they are, these flaws can eventually spread and rip the hull apart. Similarly, such cracks can kill the symmetries of a theory of gravity. There are two ways to solve these problems. One is to find band-aid solutions, like patching up the cracks with glue and bracing the wings with sticks, hoping that the rocket won't explode in the atmosphere. This is the approach historically taken by most physicists in trying to marry quantum theory with gravity. They tried to brush these two problems under the rug. The second way to proceed is to start all over again, with a new shape and new exotic materials that can withstand the stresses of space travel. Physicists had spent decades trying to patch up a quantum theory of gravity, only to find it hopelessly riddled with new divergences and anomalies. Gradually, they realized the solution might be to abandon the band-aid approach and adopt an entirely new theory. String bandwagon. In 1984, the tide against string theory suddenly turned. John Schwartz of Caltech and Mike Green, then at Queen Mary's College in London, showed that string theory was devoid of all the inconsistencies that had killed off so many other theories. Physicists already knew that string theory was free of mathematical divergences, but Schwartz and Green showed that it was also free of anomalies. As a result, string theory became the leading and, today, the only candidate for a theory of everything. Suddenly, a theory that had been considered essentially dead was resurrected. From a theory of nothing, string theory suddenly became a theory of everything. Scores of physicists desperately tried to read the papers on string theory. An avalanche of papers began to pour out of research laboratories around the world. Old papers that were gathering dust in the library suddenly became the hottest topic in physics. The idea of parallel universes, once considered too outlandish to be true, now came center stage in the physics community, with hundreds of conferences and literally tens of thousands of papers devoted to the subject. At times, things got out of hand, as some physicists got Nobel fever. In August 1991, Discover magazine even splashed on its cover the sensational title, "The New Theory of Everything, A Physicist Tackles the Ultimate Cosmic Riddle." The article quoted one physicist who was in hot pursuit of fame and glory. "I'm not one to be modest. If this works out, there will be a Nobel Prize in it," he boasted. When faced with the criticism that string theory was still in its infancy, he shot back, "The biggest string guys are saying it would take 400 years to prove strings. but I say they should shut up. The gold rush was on. Eventually, there was a backlash against the super-string bandwagon. One Harvard physicist has sneered that string theory is not really a branch of physics at all, but actually a branch of pure mathematics, or philosophy, if not religion. Nobel laureate Sheldon Glashow of Harvard led the charge, comparing the superstring bandwagon to the Star Wars program, which consumes vast resources yet can never be tested. Glashow has said that he is actually quite happy that so many young physicists work on string theory because, he says, it keeps them out of his hair. When asked about Witten's comment that string theory may dominate physics for the next 50 years in the same way that quantum mechanics dominated the last 50 years, he replies that string theory will dominate physics the same way that Kaluza-Klein theory, which he considers kooky, dominated physics for the last 50 years, which is not at all. He tried to keep string theorists out of Harvard, but as the next generation of physicists shifted to string theory, even the lone voice of a Nobel laureate was soon drowned out. Harvard has since hired several young string theorists. Cosmic Music. Einstein once said that if a theory did not offer a physical picture that even a child could understand, then it was probably useless. Fortunately, behind string theory, there is a simple physical picture, a picture based on music. According to string theory, if you had a super microscope and could peer into the heart of an electron, you would see not a point particle, but a vibrating string. The string is extremely tiny, at the Planck length of 10 to the negative 33rd power centimeters, a billion billion times smaller than a proton, so all subatomic particles appear point-like. If we were to pluck this string, the vibration would change. The electron might turn into a neutrino. Pluck it again, and it might turn into a quark. In fact, if you plucked it hard enough, it could turn into any one of the known subatomic particles. In this way, string theory can effortlessly explain why there are so many subatomic particles. They are nothing but different notes that one can play on a superstring. To give an analogy, on a violin string, the notes A or B or C sharp are not fundamental. By simply plucking the string in different ways, we can generate all the notes of the musical scale. B-flat, for example, is not more fundamental than G. All of them are nothing but notes on a violin string. In the same way, electrons and quarks are not fundamental, but the string is. In fact, all the subparticles of the universe can be viewed as nothing but different vibrations of the string. The harmonies of the string are the laws of physics. Strings can interact by splitting and rejoining, thus creating the interactions we see among electrons and protons in atoms. In this way, through string theory, we can reproduce all the laws of atomic and nuclear physics. The melodies that can be written on strings correspond to the laws of chemistry. The universe can now be viewed as a vast symphony of strings. Not only does string theory explain the particles of the quantum theory as the musical notes of the universe, it explains Einstein's relativity theory as well. The lowest vibration of the string, a spin 2 particle with zero mass, can be interpreted as the graviton, a particle or quantum of gravity. If we calculate the interactions of these gravitons, we find precisely Einstein's old theory of gravity in quantum form. As the string moves and breaks and reforms, it places enormous restrictions on space-time. When we analyze these constraints, we again find Einstein's old theory of general relativity. Thus, string theory neatly explains Einstein's theory with no additional work. Edward Witten has said that if Einstein had never discovered relativity, his theory might have been discovered as a byproduct of string theory. General relativity, in some sense, is for free. The beauty of string theory is that it can be likened to music. Music provides the metaphor by which we can understand the nature of the universe, both at the subatomic level and at the cosmic level. As the celebrated violinist Yehudi Menuhin once wrote,